Before we begin the day's call, we have a motion for admission to the bar. If I could ask Mr. Johnson to come forward with his candidate. Good morning, Mr. Johnson.
Good morning, Your Honor. I'm pleased this morning to sponsor for admission into this bar Jennifer Lynn DeBoer. Ms. DeBoer is a product of Hope College in Michigan and thereafter Valparaiso University School of Law, where she was law school editor. While at Valpo, she externed for District Judge Teresa Springman. She thereafter was admitted to the Court of Indiana and practices before the Northern and Southern Districts of Indiana as well as the Northern District of Illinois. While practicing, Jennifer's had the opportunity to individually handle several state court matters and to sit second chair with me in district court matters. As a matter of fact, she had the opportunity to appear before the Indiana Supreme Court and made new law with regard to the area of mediation this past year. I have found Jennifer during the last 4 years to be highly motivated, honest, ethical, hardworking, and articulate. She does have one drawback, however, and that's the fact that she's married to a lawyer. Her husband, Mike, is the former court clerk for District Court Judge Teresa Springman. When his clerkship ended, they gave up the beauty of Northwest Indiana and moved to the Colorado Rockies. However, she continues to split her time between working on cases with the firm and raising her new son, Benjamin. While we've not been able to lure her back to the Midwest, this case did have the opportunity to bring her back just for the moment. For those reasons and many more, I respectfully move the admission of Jennifer Lynn DeBoer.
And I'm very pleased to grant your motion, and we're very pleased, Mr. Burr, to welcome you as a member of the bar of this court and an officer of this court. It seems a little bit redundant since you've already served with Judge Springman, and you certainly are a member of the federal judicial family already, but this makes it official in just one other way. If you please go over to the clerk's desk, the clerk will administer the oath. Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you.
The court will now turn to this morning's docket. And the first case is number 033964, you against the Attorney General. Ms. Jackson.
Good morning. Shannon Jackson on behalf of the petitioner, Ji Kai Yu. This is an asylum case, and it boils down very simply to the irreparable harm that my client will suffer if he's sent back to China, which outweighs the U.S. government's interest in returning him there. His only crime was distributing literature the Chinese government felt threatened by because they did not understand it. He's a young man with his whole life ahead of him, and he will in no way burden our society. The Seventh Circuit has repeatedly held that testimony is alone enough to sustain the burden of proof in an asylum case. The petitioner here compellingly testified that his home was ransacked and his family was threatened by the police. The police were looking for him as well as his parents. The petitioner's testimony was bolstered by several Department of State reports submitted by the government that demonstrate that the crackdown in China on the Falun Gong movement continues and that Falun Gong practitioners are routinely detained, abused, committed to insane asylums against their will, and tortured. And that includes those, such as my client, who merely distribute the Falun Gong literature. My client is not a member of the Falun Gong movement. However, the Chinese authorities have imputed membership to him. The reason for this is because his parents were involved in the movement, and he assisted his parents in helping them to distribute, sell the literature for the Falun Gong movement. The immigration judge below focused on the fact that my client is not, in fact, a member of the Falun Gong movement. However, this focus was inappropriate. Case law and statutes specifically allow for imputed opinion to be the basis of an asylum claim. In fact, the DOS reports and a Ninth Circuit case cited the case of two women in China who were sentenced 1 to 6 years and 1 to 7 years in a labor camp just for distributing Falun Gong material when they themselves were not members of the movement. Next, the immigration judge focused on the fact that my client did not know where his parents were. This focus was also misguided. The fact that my client was unable to contact his parents actually affirms his claim. His parents are so afraid of being persecuted for their participation in this movement that they feel they cannot tell their own son their location. Further, several courts have held that it's inappropriate to base a candidate's credibility on his ability to obtain affidavits from people who are outside of the United States, and that would especially be the case here when his parents are, in fact, in hiding and have fled from arrest. Finally, the immigration judge below failed to consider the chance for my client to be tortured upon his return to China. In cases of imputed membership to the Falun Gong, as I said earlier, the crackdown continues. China's human rights record, as this court has said in recent cases, is dismal, and the chance, it is clearly more likely than not that someone who has already been imputed with this membership will be detained by the authorities upon his return.
The immigration judge was troubled by a number of things. The $20,000 in cash that he came up with to get someone to get him out of the country and all that. Why is that a finding that we shouldn't defer to? I mean, it isn't easy to come up with $20,000 in cash.
That's very true.
In China.
Yeah, that's very true. My client testified that he obtained this money from an aunt who lived in the United States. And
I thought it was from a grandmother.
It was also from a grandmother. I believe he got the money from two different sources, was his testimony. In that case, the immigration judge did rely on reports that the typical cost is higher. However, there's not a lot of concrete evidence of that. The Department of State report, well, the Canadian version of the Department of State is the governmental body that issued this report, saying that it cost, I believe, $33,000 to $40,000, when my client testified that he only paid $20,000. There's really no record of that. I mean, these are people who are illegally trafficking people. So to say that they have a set price, you know, there's a market. Perhaps at the time, the market was down. You know, I don't know what the exchange rate was at the time. There's many reasons that he could have been able to pay less than what recent studies have indicated is actually the cost. Finally, granting asylum here would not be a case of opening the floodgates. There are two reasons that the Chinese government has an interest in this particular person. One is the circumstances under which he fled. He never gave the authorities the chance to interrogate him. He emigrated illegally. He fled from arrest. The authorities already suspected that he was distributing the literature. The second reason is his parents also fled, and this would lead to a reasonable inference of suspicion on the entire family. If suddenly they all disappear, it's perfectly reasonable to think that the government might have a specific interest in this case. His parents were warned several times prior to the incident of ransacking the home. And as I said earlier, they're still in hiding. They're still afraid of being persecuted in China. Are there any other questions from the panel?
Apparently not. Thank you, Ms. Jackson.
Thank you.
We'll hear now from Mr. Marstella.
May it please the Court, Eric Marstella for the United States Attorney General. This case involves a native and citizen of China who was denied asylum because he did not meet his burden in proving a showing he did not meet his burden in showing that he had an objectively reasonable, well-founded fear of persecution if he returned to China. The IJ's findings regarding no objectively reasonable fear are findings of fact and therefore subject to this Court's highly deferential substantial evidence test. The Court can disturb the findings only if the immigration judge, only if the record is so compelling that no reasonable fact finder could fail to find the requisite fear of persecution. In this case, substantial evidence supports the IJ's finding that petitioner did not meet his burden, showing that he had a well-founded fear. Petitioner testified that he was not a member of Falun Gong, that he had never been abused by the government, that he had never been specifically threatened by the government, that he had never been harmed by the government. All he did was he aided his parents as they peddled goods on the sidewalk, selling popsicles, comic books, and, quoting the petitioner, occasionally, not very often, but on and off, Falun Gong materials. It's doubtful that the authorities were ever after petitioner, given his very tangential contact with the Falun Gong. He did not satisfy his burden of presenting specific detailed facts showing a good reason to fear that he will be singled out. There are millions of Falun Gong adherents in China, tens of millions according to the State Department country report, nearly all of whom whose involvement in Falun Gong is by many degrees greater than the petitioners. Only a tiny fraction have ever been arrested, and many of those were arrested for demonstrating. It was reasonable for the immigration judge to find that petitioner's fear was exaggerated and not objectively reasonable. The judge just was not persuaded that the authorities were really after petitioner, given his limited interaction with the authorities. This conclusion was reasonable based on his testimony that he was not an adherent, that he only assisted his parents. Only assisted his parents in the sale of Falun Gong books, and only for a very limited time, and that he and his parents were warned repeatedly to stop selling books, and that there were no other face-to-face confrontations with the authorities. Moreover, petitioner's testimony regarding his parents, called sketchy by the immigration judge, was vague, meandering, and lacked substance. Petitioner's testimony was that from March 1st, 2001, when he alleges that his home was ransacked by authorities, until early 2002, he had no contact with his parents. But from early 2002 until the immigration hearing, he had spoken to them on the phone about 5 times. Yet he still does not know where they were at the time of the immigration hearing, and he also did not know where they had been between March 2001 and his time in the United States. Moreover, he did not adequately corroborate his testimony. This court has held that it is reasonable to expect corroboration where the alien's story is not accepted at face value. In this case, the immigration judge made clear that he did not accept at face value the story of the immigrant, and therefore corroboration was necessary. Failure to supplement testimony with corroborating evidence can lead to a finding that an applicant has failed to meet his burden of proof. Moreover, that petitioner's parents are still in China without incident undermines his claim that he would be singled out for persecution or that he cannot safely relocate within China. Finally, petitioner's testimony regarding his rapid departure from China is implausible, and the petitioner did not prove that the record compels the conclusion that petitioner was eligible for asylum. It's not believable that petitioner's exigency was warranted. He stated that about 15 days after the March 1st incident, his grandmother contacted the authorities, contacted smugglers, rather, to set up a way for him to leave the country. And just 5 days after that, $20,000 had been raised, and he was smuggled out of the country. It's difficult to believe that the sense of urgency that petitioner tries to state was really present, and the immigration judge was correct in finding that sense of urgency exaggerated by the petitioner. Moreover, petitioner's testimony regarding his departure and how the money was raised was inconsistent. Initially, he testified Initially, he testified that his grandmother took out a loan from some of her relatives in the 5 or 6 days before she made the payment to the smugglers. Later, he testified that it was not a loan, but rather a remittance from relatives in the United States that she had been receiving for a long time and apparently saving up. Moreover, his testimony regarding how he received his money was neither clear nor detailed. The immigration judge's decision was supported by substantial evidence. The IJ reasonably found petitioner's testimony exaggerated and unpersuasive. Petitioner has not demonstrated that the record evidence is so compelling that no reasonable fact finder could fail to find him eligible for asylum. This court, therefore, should deny the petition.
Thank you, Mr. Marstella. And you have 3 minutes, Ms. Jackson.
Thank you, Your Honor. The government's contention that my client did not meet his burden of proof is simply not supported by the record. His testimony was specific and consistent and detailed. Although it is true that the money that he said he raised did not correspond with reports from the Canadians' version of the Department of State, that doesn't really go to the nexus of the complaint. That doesn't go to the heart of his claim. It doesn't really matter if he knew where the money came from. He was 18 years old at the time. He's a young kid. He probably did not have the maturity to appreciate the details of where the money was coming from and what was happening to him. All he knew was that he needed to leave the country. He also testified that there were several other people in his village who were being arrested and abused because of their participation in this Falun Gong movement. It's true that he himself was never arrested. However, the current country conditions suggest that there's a great probability that he would be arrested upon his return, especially, as I said before, due to the circumstances under which he left the country. Once the government suspects that one is distributing this literature, that would automatically raise a flag for them. The Department of State reports indicate that the government is producing a massive campaign against this movement. The Chinese government is looking to put down all aspects of this movement, not only the demonstrators, not only the people in the parks who are practicing it, but also the people who are distributing the literature, the people who are jamming the television waves, the people who are putting out websites. The government does not want any information about this movement disseminated any further. They feel that they are trying to contain this movement and, in fact, eliminate it. So
in other words, everybody is, you said you wouldn't open the floodgates with a case like this, but your argument would seem to suggest that anyone who has any tangential connection to the Falun Gong movement would be entitled to asylum in America.
Well,
Where do you draw the line?
My client's connection here, I believe, is more than tangential. It's true that there are many millions of practitioners in China. However, the fact that he has fled the country, that he was distributing literature, and that everyone was the Chinese government was aware of this, would suggest that there would be a specific interest in this case.
Well, thank you, Ms. Jackson.
Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel, and the case will be taken under advisement.